Mickey Hart here, you're listening to the GAA Hour Football Show.
The GAA Hour with Colin Parkinson is sponsored by AIB, proudly backing club and county.
I'm not finished yet, it took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
All right, delighted to say we've got Cathal McCarron in studio to talk about his new book, Out of Control. Cathal, just to start off with, I couldn't leave the book down. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Like, the honesty throughout the book, it was like an education. You know, I hadn't really had my eyes opened up to that kind of life. You know, the depths that you would go to with that addiction. You know, was writing the book a difficult process?
Thanks for having me on, Colm, first of all. It wasn't as hard as I maybe thought it was going to be. I obviously have been in, I've done an awful lot of work counselling myself and rehabilitation to get back to where I am today. And a lot of people ask me that question, was it good therapy doing the book?
Yeah.
It was, in a way. There were some parts of it where I looked at it from my parents' perspective and maybe seen how they were being affected by things I'd done and stuff like that. And but like with Christy, it was just like a match made in heaven. Just we got on really well, you know. And I think he quickly got the grips of, wow, like this addiction, this gambling addiction is you know, the worst thing he ever experienced or been part of. And like it's been a tough journey. I don't think people see probably how tough it has been. They see me playing football and that's it, and the TV's off or they leave the grounds, that's it. But it has been a very tough journey to get to where I am today. And but at the same time, it's been a wonderful journey. You might look at that and think, how could you say that? But it's probably made me to be the person I am today. And I probably wouldn't have been that person if I hadn't gone through what I'd done, you know.
Yeah. Why write the book? Because that's a lot of people say to me when I've told them I'm going to interview you. You know, you're away from gambling for 3 years. You know, you've been through this process before and fell off the wagon. You know, there's people out there going to say, why the book now when you're actually just, you know, you're pretty much at the start of your recovery process?
Yeah. The reason that I wrote the book, two reasons. The reason why I done it was to give the people that are going to come behind me that bit of hope, and maybe to say that, look, at you can fall to where I went to, whether it be an average person, businessman, sportsman, and get back doing and get back playing at the highest level again and get back doing what you love doing. And that's the main aim of the book, is to give people hope, you know. Yeah. More so than anything. And the other reason is probably to give people an insight into who I am, and not to like, there's been a lot thrown at me this last two and a half, 3 years, headlines and stuff, and I've sat back and just took it all and just put my head down and worked away. And it's almost, writing the book was almost like a voice to get across that I'm only a normal person that just got caught up in this awful, awful disease. And to give, like, I know, I deal with and try and work on a lot and help an addiction at the moment, and I know there's an awful lot of people suffering in the GAA community at the moment, and it only seems to be getting worse. And it'll probably be, you know, there'll probably be another story, and it's an awful thing to say, there'll probably be another story in the not so near, you know, in the future. And if my book can inspire and give somebody hope, then that was the main aim of the book, you know, to give that person that bit of strength and hope.
Yeah, and look, I'd say that's you've even mentioned in the book that it's worked in that regard. There are people coming towards you because, like, you know, you put your story out there, and you know, which it all culminated in the gay porn incident, and that was at you at your very lowest ebb, thought about taking your own life. So if you can turn it around and become get your career back, get your football back, you know, that anybody else can do that as well.
Yeah, and Yeah, if I can do it, why can somebody else not do it? You know, there's nothing special about me. There's nowhere, you know, I'm just another normal person. And if, like I said, it hasn't been a cakewalk by any means, but it's been a long, long, hard journey. And but it's just that I can do it, everyone else can do it too, you know. And
yeah.
Another reason, I read somewhere that, why did you write the book now? To me personally, I got some of the abuse I got last year, I got when there was no book out, and I'm still going to get the same abuse as I got last year that I'm going to get this year or next year.
Yeah.
So to me, it's regardless. That didn't mean anything. The book is mainly to give people in addiction and in recovery hope, and it's not about, like, I'm still going to take the same slack as I got last year, next year.
Yeah.
With a book out or not.
Yeah.
So it's just accepting it, you know.
I rang a friend of mine from Tyrone, actually, and I was talking about you, and we ended up having an argument, and he was saying, look, that fella's got enough chances. You know, he's a bad egg, he was telling me. And I was like, did you read the book? No. And I was reading Danny Hughes's piece last week, and he's kind of giving out complaining about the book and writing the book. And he admitted in the second paragraph he didn't read the book. Like, I would challenge anyone to read the book, because before I read it, I was like McCarran again. Like, because you've obviously got gambling addiction problems, which we're going to get into. You also have anger management issues. And, like, are you separating both of those as two different problems that you have, or do you see them as all interlinked?
They're all interlinked in a way, above probably, you know, coming from childhood. Like, I'm training to be a psychotherapist and counsellor at the moment, and we believe that most problems come from childhood to make you the person you are today. And a lot of my anger would come from childhood, being that wee young lad and I suppose not being able to do anything, you know. And
yeah, so anyone that hasn't read the book, your parents were fighting a lot when you were younger, and your mother ended up leaving home, and you started acting up in school and getting in fights.
Like, I think people just I'm not out to make people want to like me, but I think people don't look into the story and see why I done this and why I behave in this way. I've had a great upbringing. At the same time, I've had a really tough upbringing as well. Like, I know it's hard to come around, but my parents were really good to us, but they probably were hurting us in the ways they probably didn't think they were. But there was a lot going on behind the scenes, and you know, we had to go into school and put on the mask, and everything was all right. And you know, that probably had a huge effect. I could have hooked to something else as quick as gambling. I could have hooked to drugs as quickly. So,
yeah.
You know, if I had went down that path, sure, look, I mightn't have been even here today, you know.
Yeah, you were angry when you're in school, getting in fights. And at the age of 16, you put on your first bet, and you said in the book that was kind of a release from that anger, that you didn't feel that when it was, you know, an exhilarating experience.
Yeah, I used to have a lot of anger in me, and I used to be put outside the class. Like, I would have been a right smart fellow growing up. Like, I'd have been all in good classes and that, and I just didn't want to learn, and you know what. I just didn't want to be in school. I was angry, and when I put on these bets, it felt like there was a bubble around me that nothing can. I'm happy here, you know.
Yeah.
It's very hard to describe, but it almost was like a force field around you that nobody could enter, and you were happy, you know. And no matter what was going on in the real world, it was like it didn't matter for that 3 minutes that you had a bet on in a horse race. It was just. That's all that mattered at that time.
Yeah, so you said by 17 you were pretty much addicted, that it had taken hold on you very quickly, really.
Mm-hmm. It took hold of me 17. From 16, 17, 18, I was compulsive gambler. I mean, like, I was working as a bricklayer, and I bought a new car and wasn't able to pay for it because I was getting good money. Like, at that time,
you stopped the boom making the repayments.
Stopped making the repayments, and the car was lifted. Like, and that was an awful shame for a young lad, for the car to have to be lifted. And then I was telling people that I hit the car, and I was telling lies. And it's just around gambling, my whole life was telling lies, because I was trying to cover up lies that were created due to gambling or things that happened. So it was one big lie, and it had been tough. It had been very tough, and my father probably. He had a business, a successful business, and the money was always easy to get around the house. And I rationalised in my head, you know, that I'll take this money it's my father's, it's not really stealing. That's yeah. the rationalization I put it in my head, and it just went from that to worse, to worse, to worse. And probably Daddy was probably enabling me in a way, in a slight way, that he obviously loved me and was trying to protect me, but he probably was enabling me as well by not probably punishing me. Probably, you know, he was letting things go, and it just spiraled out of control from there, you know.
Yeah, you described yourself in the book as a conniving, sneaky bastard, you know, when you're trying to get money for mm-hmm. that gambling. And there was one example, like, you're able to manipulate your father that when he would challenge you, you'd start blaming him, you know, for fights with his mother and say, how dare you, and make your father feel like a small, you know, horrible person when you were actually fleecing him behind his back, you know. That's the kind of level that you were at.
It's when you look back now, like, I just think my dad is, he's a wonderful man, like, you know, that I was able to, I was, that was just the way I was. I was so manipulative. I could turn something around on somebody else and make them feel bad, and it was me that done the wrong thing. It just was, it was part of me at that stage, part of my character, and, but I still could do an awful lot of good, but people would forget about the good as soon as I'd done something bad, and I knew there was always, the goodness was always there. I'd be the first to say I'm a soft-hearted, I'm a soft oil creator, like, I wouldn't be, and would think a lot, and if I knew that I was anyway a bad person, then, like, I don't know, like, I always knew the goodness was there.
Yeah.
But it was when Cahill was gambling, like, I remember, I'll never forget, a friend said to me that, you know, everyone likes Cahill McCarron when he's not gambling, but when he gambles, he's just, nobody wants anything to do with him.
So when you're in that stage of trying to chase more money, and you're in the, you know, the height of gambling, like, you can't rationalize anything in your mind. You can't say, right, I'm a good person. You don't care about that.
When I'm trying to chase money, I have this wonderful mechanism in my mind or my head that I can put it to the side and just think, right, you know, I'll say it in my head a few times and it'll become all right.
But you're aware of what you're doing.
I'm aware. At the start, right, I'll think to myself, I can't do that. That's wrong.
Yeah.
And the more I say it in my mind, I start to find ways. Oh, well, sure, I'm only doing it because of this. It's so hard to explain. But I rationalized that much so I could see that I was doing something that something that I think would be awful, that it didn't become that bad.
Yeah. Your mother actually moved out of home, and, you know, you're obviously disappointed about that, but the gambler, the devil on your shoulder, is telling you this is a huge opportunity here, and you started ordering credit cards for your mother to the house and scammed money out of fake mm-hmm. credit cards for a long time as well.
Yeah, that's the gambler and the conniving side of me. Always thinking of when I can't get money myself and my money goes from working, where do I get money elsewhere? And, like, the majority of my money I took, 90% of it was from my parents, and I rationalised that because I used to say to myself, well, you know, this is my mom and dad, it's kind of like my money, you know. And like, when you look back, like, it was such an insane way to be thinking. And but at the time, you can't think nothing else. That's all I was thinking was, it's like almost like a heroin addict, I need the money to gamble. It's like they need the drug to put in them for the hit. Without the money, I don't have my buzz. So yeah, for me, the closest form of addiction I can find to gambling is heroism addiction, would you believe? I work a lot with drug addicts, and, you know, they put the hit, the drug in the body, but they need to get their hands on it first. It's like almost like we need to get our hands on money.
Yeah.
And without money, we can do nothing. And the only peace of mind I have is when I don't have money. When my bank account says zero, I'll have peace of mind for that day or that night. It's the only time I'm happy is when I have no money.
Incredible, you stuff know? And you even said in the book that you enjoyed the chase. Then the chase will start then the next day of how do I get back getting money for, and then when you get it, that's the rush.
Never stops. Never ending. Like you have no money that night and you're like, Jesus, just this relief, thank God I'm away from that betting. I'm sitting in the bookies all day, like, or online all day gambling, and you know. But once the next day comes, it becomes like a new day, new energy. I'm going till, you know, if I've no money, right, how do I get money? How do I get money and doesn't make me look bad, or how can I get it? And, you know, I never, ever, 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 consequence was a massive word for me, even in recovery. I never thought about consequences.
Yeah.
I acted and then just rationalised in my head, oh, it'll be all right. I'll get over it, it'll be grand. Like, it's hard for somebody to understand that unless you're in addiction or in recovery. You know, it's hard to get your head around. How can you think like this? But if I was sitting around a meeting here with 15 people in a GA meeting, they'd all be saying, I understand completely. I've been there. We all have the same thought process. It's amazing. And it's not until you come into a room and you turn around and listen to everyone else's story and you sit to yourself and go, that's just me there, opposite me. You know, and I don't think people are aware of that in the public. They're just quick to judge any addict, for that matter. And I'm working with addicts now quite a while and stuff, and I have yet to see a bad one, you know, behind it all.
Yeah, there's a couple of great anecdotes in it. Well, like sad anecdotes, really, about, you know, the levels you went to get money, and you maybe blew a thousand, you had 20 left, you had no diesel in your car, the red light was on, and it didn't even enter your head for a second not to bet that last 20. Then you go out to the car, scrounge around, find four euros or pounds, and like I'm thinking, go get diesel when I'm reading it, and this didn't enter your head either. You're back in, you lose the four, and you end up pushing your car to the petrol station.
Back in, and like at the time I thought, Jesus, how am I going to get home? When I left the bookies, I put the £20 on and there was nothing left. I thought, how am I going to get home here? Because I knew I wasn't going to get home. Like, I knew I was on the border. I was on the light for a while. And I scourged the car, pulled seats apart, pulled things apart to get £4 or something in change. And that would have been enough to get me home. But when I got the money, the addiction pulled me back into the bookies to think to myself, well, I can get £4 into £10 and £10. Because I've done it before, and that's the problem.
Right.
I've often been down to a tenner, and I've worked myself up to maybe £1,000 from a tenner.
Right.
And it's the way they explain it is that if you cut a page in half and you put the positives and negatives and wrote down all the times you won the money from £10, maybe it was maybe two incidents or one incident, and you write down the other side all the times you've lost. You could put pages, but I held on to the positive where I won once or twice, so. I found out in my recovery too that I suffer from positivity, and I know that's a strange thing to think about, but I'm always looking for the positive in everything I do, and I suppose I think only for that it got me to where I am today. It got me through all the tough spell as well as the negative, but it got me through the storm I was in, and I suppose it's... It isn't a good thing either. I'm constantly working on it. I'm constantly working on myself till the day I end up in the grave, I suppose. But I'm far from perfect, and I would always say that. But I'm trying my best, you know. And the thing I would say about the gambling is that it's not aware. People are not aware how bad it is yet. I think some people are, but it's going to become an epidemic, because it's too easy to gamble on your phone, and there's children now doing it in school, and you know it's just an awful disease, and you know it's going to be worse in the year to come.
It you know, some of the things that you went to get money, and you talked about being conniving. It's like you had money at one time, and I'm trying to paint a picture of the levels you were going to. You had money one time, and instead of gambling it, you were conniving enough to go, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm going to go down and spend some money in that shop, and I'll spend the money in the shop every week until the fella who owns the shop trusts me. And then when you got to a level where he could trust you, you started writing him fake checks, you know, and like that's the conniving side, and that's the side that's basically willing to do anything for money.
Yeah, and when you're in that addiction... Like I've heard people say, and I've read about it, that you know that's only their excuses, but that's like I actually can laugh at myself to think if that's an excuse. It's people reading the book, people listening to me, people that are in addiction or in recovery will understand everything about it, but the person that's not, like my loved ones try and understand this addiction, but they can't.
Yeah.
And they never will. And they're the closest people to me as I'm going to get. My partner, Niamh, is really, really good, but still doesn't understand it fully. You know, it's just... It's impossible to describe it. And like as you said, like to buying... I'll build up someone's trust, and then when they blink, that's when I'll take advantage of them, you know.
Because that's the question I was going to ask you as well. Like, you've, outside of your parents who you know best, all the people you robbed are people you know well. Like, you've robbed best friends, you've robbed your whole community. That'll just get to, that was before nearly your first rock bottom, before you went into recovery. Yeah. But there's part of me thinking, Jesus, Cahill, go into Derry and rob some houses from people you don't, you know what I mean? You don't know at all, and don't make it as personal. But like, I mean, you're probably thinking, these are the easiest targets I can even find, bad and all as that sounds.
Well, look, what the thing about addiction is, the hardest thing about addiction is for the families and friends and all, that the people that you love the most and trust the most, and they love you and stuff, they are the people that you're going to hurt. It's not this random stranger, or, like, I would never have thought twice about taking money off somebody I didn't know. It's just, I know it's a mad thing to think about. It's just, I just thought that, you know, the person knows me, he might understand that I'm taking this to, it's because I'm not well.
Right. But that's how you justify it.
I would justify it by saying to myself that, like, I've taken money off people, but I haven't, I know there's a lot of stories and all going around and this and that. And it's blew up a lot worse than it actually is, but I'd say, you know, people have taken the most money from, and I'd say 90 to 95%. There's a very minority, small minority that have done things to outside of the family, but all I can do now is say to them people and I have that I'm, I was like, if Cathal McCarron was never gambling or ever involved in it, or I would never have been in situations that I was in or been, because I was brought up well from a good working family, and like it's where gambling led me to, and where, how it warped my mind and took hold of me, and like I can only say I'm sorry, and hopefully people will accept it.
Yeah. And are people around Tyrone beginning to accept it, or is there obviously a little bit of opposition?
I think majority of people understand now how bad it was for me, and I don't expect pity. I don't want pity from anybody. I don't want people to go, oh Jesus, I feel sorry for him. I don't want that. All I want is for people to understand maybe that wee bit better, and not be as quick to judge me. You know, if they're judging me, like I'd always say, even as you said, read the book, like, you know, and not be as quick to judge me. But you're going to get people anyway that's not going to like you, even if they read the book and have their mind made up. But that's fine, like, that's fine with me. I'm not going till, you know, run around, and I don't want people to like me. I just want people to maybe think, God, that's why he done what he done, and, you know, it's an awful addiction, and make people more aware of how bad it is, because if a lot of people that were to behave the way they behaved with me, like, who's to say that their child growing up could suffer from addiction or from gambling, and, like, would they treat them the same, you know? And it's open people up till the awareness of that it's not a, gambling is not something that people do, and just not gambling, addiction, it's not people that people set out to hurt people, and especially their loved ones. They have no control over who they hurt, and like, by God, I love my family as much as anybody in the world, and I would do anything for them, but yet they are the people that hurt the most.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, the gambling is the worst of them all, because junkies, you can see a mile away. You know, alcoholics, you kind of know. You used the example or analogy in the book of, like, a junkie is like a washing machine, and as it's turning, you can see the different coloured clothes.
An alcoholic, yeah.
Yeah, an alcoholic, sorry.
Yeah.
Whereas a gambler is like a dryer, where everything's spinning so fast that you can't tell one from the other.
Yeah, and it was put to me that in addiction, when I was in recovery, and, you know, I thought it was a fascinating way to look at things, because the gambler can fully function.
Yeah.
And walk down the street. You could walk down O'Connell Street today and you could see boys in suits and smiling. But yet behind all of that could be they could be in the pits of depression and perils, you know. The thing about a gambler is you can keep going till the end comes. Whereas an alcoholic, you can see very soon, very, very quickly, and a drug addict, that they can't hide it because it physically affects them, whereas a gambler doesn't, you know.
Yeah. One thing in the book that jumped out at me as well is you said you could always sleep easy despite all this stuff going on. How could you do that?
The only time, again, rationalising everything I'd done, you know, I'd never really caused me to have that many sleepless nights. And people might look on this and go, Jesus, how could it not? But it was just the way my mind operated. It just rationalised everything. And the only night I never had a sleepless night was when the news come in about the porn and my Twitter feed, was the only night I went through hell, you know?
Yeah.
And probably was, it was probably all them nights that I didn't sleep, that I did sleep with, probably just all in one, you know? It was horrible. And there's words out there people ask me to describe what was it like, and I can't, because it was hell on earth, you know? It was just, it was a bad place, you know?
Yeah, no, we'll definitely get to that, because that's, you know, that was the beginning of you turning everything back around. So maybe, you know, it was like a corner that you were able to turn then. The end of the first kind of stint of gambling came when you set up a fake charity around Dromore, and you got caught and you broke down to your friends. You saw Oisín McConville and you went into treatment. So you went 3 months into treatment, did really well. Really difficult first week, because I was surprised to hear that you were in with, you know, the drug addicts and the alcoholics who were having massive withdrawal symptoms, smell of puke. You can probably take it up from there. It wasn't a good time.
It wasn't a good time, but at the same time, like, I wouldn't hold anything against Coonmurra. That's the way they do things. And look at it, it's probably a good thing, because you're just another person like anybody else, and you shouldn't be getting any special attention when you're in there, no matter who you are. And it took me a week or two to lose this attitude I had, you know.
Because you had an ego, didn't you?
I have an ego. I had an ego. I don't know why I had an ego, because it was only starting out in my football career, and you know, I think it come from being a gambler. I just put
it's
up
a front.
Front of the,
yeah.
It's a front of being a big man, and we're all, you know, it's a pure mask. You know, behind the mask there was an insecure, probably vulnerable person. You know, but the mask on was a different person.
Yeah, in Coonmurra you described your mind has to slow down. Mm-hmm. Like the mind of a gambler is just going 1,000 miles an hour. You just can't stop thinking and plotting. You know, and eventually your mind started to calm down a little bit.
Mine started to calm down, and they say it takes 6 or 7 weeks before a gambler's mind will start to slow down till you actually can start your recovery. So I know you do 3 months in there. I think probably it's probably should be longer, you know. It could be maybe 6 months, 5 months. That's my own personal opinion. You know, at that stage it was very tough. I was first time away from family. I was in over Christmas. It was probably the coldest winter. I think it was 2009. It was a real bad winter, and it was a tough time for me. And at that time, like, I thought probably, you know, I was listening to all the stories and GA meetings in the house, and I was only a young cub, like, and there was a lot of people in there who were 40 and 50 and 60, had blue mortgages and blue things, and they were telling me, you know, you're lucky, you're so lucky to have caught this at this age. In a way, that gave me a lot of hope to say, look, I am young, I can turn things around here. And the weeks went by, and, you know, I met a good few friends in there that are still in contact to this day. And, you know, my whole perspective, even at 21, it started to change pretty quickly. The Ciathal that was there, always was there, was the mask was off. And, you know, I was a completely different person, I'd say, after 3, 4, or 5 weeks. I can see the change in myself, even, you know.
Right.
It was unbelievable. It's almost like, you know, you're walking out of one body and into another body. It's just, you're just a different person. And from leaving Killarn, I probably had the next 3 years, the best 3 years of my life, gambling free, and until it all went wrong, I suppose, by me thinking that I had no problem. That's where it all started again.
Did you go into rehab the first time because you got caught doing a terrible thing, or did you think that you needed the help? Or
it was a mixture of both. I don't think a gambler is going to come to you and say, I've had enough. It's going to take an event to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know, and this is what I'd always say to loved ones that have a family member in the depth of it and doesn't want to stop. You know, it's very hard for a family member to sit by and watch, but for an addict, it's very hard. He'll not go in and say, I've done enough damage here, I'm going into recovery.
Yeah.
Something has to happen. And
does that snap you out of it?
It's it's almost like the family has to be, but I would turn around and say, and it's so hard for them to hear, that you almost have to just let the boy continue to do what he's doing until he hits his rock bottom, and all you can be there is there for him when he does it. And his rock bottom could be the smallest thing to them, but it could be their rock bottom. And it's almost like to be there for your, to be there for your loved one, you know, in this time of need. And it's hard for a family member to hear that, because they're sitting there with their son or daughter and saying, he needs help, he needs help now. Whereas the son could be sitting there thinking, I don't want help, I'm not finished yet, you know. And it was a mixture of that happening to me and my friends calling up, where friends should be calling up having the crack, we not calling up and telling you, look, lad, you need to go and get sorted here, you're in a bad way. And it was a mixture of that and the release I had from it being out and open.
Breaking
and
been off my
shoulders, the weight. The relief was unbelievable. And I remember going down to Killarney that first day, the next day, and looking out the window, and I was crying. I cried the whole way down, I think. And just think, like, the weight off my shoulders is unreal here. I can actually... I'm going to spend 3 months probably in rehab away from my family over Christmas. Probably the most hardest thing I'm ever going to have to do. But I was in a sense of relief.
Yeah. You know? Even if you're 21 as well. 21. Like, I mean, it's incredible to go through all that at such a young age and have to be able to process this and have to recover. You know, 21 is... you're not mature enough to be dealing with all this at that age.
No, and I really feel for young guys and girls in addiction that... And I meet many of them that are in Coonmore and in rehab and they're 20 and 21 and they're trying to get well. But it's almost like, you know, it's you haven't done enough yet, you know, and it's sad. And I would love to wish, I'd love to see every 21-year-old come in getting sobriety, but it's probably doesn't happen. The minority do. And you're very immature at that stage and, you probably say to yourself, you forget. It's like a good team talk. Things are going bad with your club or your county and you have a meeting, a crisis meeting, and you have this powerful meeting and you leave the meeting with all these intentions and you have this energy. The same with gambling. You do so well for a short period of time and then you forget. You know, you stop doing things that you should be doing.
You think you're better.
And you think you're better and the arrogance starts to come back and, you know, that's why you need to be going to your meetings all the time, because it keeps you grounded. It gets you the medicine you need. And the medicine being hearing the stories of people coming in off the streets. And, like, it's an awful thing to say, but for me, my medicine is listening to a lad that has come off the street in a real bad way. It reminds me where I can go if I gamble again. And it's a process that we hope that everybody in there hopes that Pella will see, get help, and the next he'll be sitting where I am someday. You know, it's like a conveyor belt, you know.
Yeah, because you did fall back into gambling. Like you said, you were off it. Football was going great. You were in love. Your life was in a good place, and then you started getting complacent. Like you said, there you got a bit too cocky. I'm okay now, which I think is understandable at a young age. You hadn't been through that before, and suddenly then you start checking betting websites, not putting on a bet. But that's enough, you know, for alarm bells to start ringing. You know, you start texting other girls behind your girlfriend for a bit of a rush or a buzz as well. And you didn't know at the time to read these signals, but you were heading straight back only in one direction at that time.
I believe the first time I put a bet on mentally was when I took money from my father. I was filling the car up and I usually pay for the fuel. Like, I'd always say, there's whatever it is, £20 or whatever. And he wasn't there at the time. And I said, I'll give it to him when he comes back. And I never did. And I believe that was me gambling again from that day onwards. But I never probably physically placed a bet for about 4 or 5 months later, or 6 months maybe. But
that was the beginning of...
That was the beginning of a start again, you know.
Right, and it was Cato Star in Cheltenham, your favourite horse, the 200 euro bet.
I remember putting that bet on and physically shaking and nearly crying doing it. But it was like I couldn't stop myself from doing it. No matter, I thought of the pain I've been through, how hard it had been going through recovery, but I couldn't stop clicking the button to say bet, confirm the bet.
Because the danger when you went back the second time was the online gambling was all over the place, so you didn't actually even have, like, you had to dodge a lot of bullets going around betting offices in Tyrone, and you had to change towns. Now you could do it from the comfort of your own sofa in your own
house. Yeah, and it was probably the worst thing that happened to me. I could do it while portraying to probably be in recovery and things are going well and not life completely the opposite, you know. And you know, it was almost like it was 10 times worse, because when you have physically cash in your hand, a few hundred pounds or euros, it's quite a lot of money. When you have it on a keyboard and you're typing in 200 or 300, it's just like, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, you've no respect for that.
No respect for it. And it just went, it went from all the savings I'd saved, and I bought a new car, all I'd worked up for was wiped out in 6 months. It was the worst. It's almost like when you're in recovery, the wee gambler in you, the boy that's making you do all the things, he's doing weights in the background, waiting for you to slip up. And this will go for any, if you talk to anybody in recovery, if they relapse, it's 10 times worse.
Right.
Because the boy's stronger, he feels like he hasn't been gambling for so long, it's just, it explodes into a different level. And that's what happened to me. The 6 months I was back gambling, I was just wrote off everything I'd done, you know, in the space of the same year. I'd built up respect and got respect back, and things were going well. I wiped it completely all out, you know.
Yeah, your bets were an awful lot bigger. Just a quick thing on that, you know, the way you saw the signs of you slipping into it, it was, you know, different little things, not paying your father. Mm. Like this year, you've had that Tinder thing, which was a form of gambling as well. You know, you had some trouble in Temple Bar when you were drinking. Like, are there some warning signs to you now?
Yeah, well, look at that. They're like the thing in Temple Bar, I suppose, was people probably don't know the story. I didn't come out and say anything about it, but like, I was out for a few drinks with a few work colleagues, and to cut the long story short, I was provoked by a bouncer. I was only out for a few drinks, looking at minding my own business.
So are you supposed to be drinking? Or is drink, you know, there's no like rules that you shouldn't be drinking,
no,
or anything like that?
No. Okay. Drink never affected me, never had any effect, but right. When I'm drinking, it probably is when I'm at my most weakest, when I'm in recovery, because I can control myself, whereas if people will say something to me or to do something, whereas when I'm drinking, you know, you can lose control a lot quicker. And that's what happened. I probably was provoked enough for the boy got a reaction out of me, and I reacted, you know, and it was a bit of a scuffle, and guards come, and I was arrested for the exact same offence. My friend actually was arrested as well, and he was done for public order disorder. It's basically been drunk and disorderly, but yet they chose to convict me and let him go with a warning for the exact same crime, which we couldn't understand. Yeah. Like, you know.
Do you think you're unlucky because of your profile, or do you think you're lucky because of your profile?
I think I'm unlucky, big time. I think people see this person and think this boy's a lunatic or a nutcase. Like, I'm far from a nutcase. Like, people know me. Know I'm like, I'm not a stupid fella or anything like that. I just think that gambling has made me do some awful things, and people's perception of me is, there's people out there that I know, and they know me and know who I really am, but then the people that don't know me are the ones that judge me really badly. Yeah. And
you're a lightning rod for trouble though, aren't like you've I, been in so and I like I think your anger management is just as big an issue as your gambling, you know. That's is. Getting you in a lot of scrapes as well, and that needs a lot of work, because like I've been in a lot of trouble in my life, and you have to hold your hands up and say, right, like, I'm the common denominator all the time here, you know. Yeah. In different things. And yeah, like, definitely I think your anger management is a huge problem.
Well, look, when you look at all these things, you have to look to it yourself and go, look, they're always happening to you, so there's something not right here.
Yeah.
You know, and 100% something that I've been working on this last 2 years is my anger, and still working on it, and I don't think you can ever work on it enough. It's like addiction. You can only subdue it. It doesn't go away. But I know going forward that I have to manage myself a hell of a lot better, you know.
Yeah.
And there's things that I've done and I held my hands up. Like anybody else gets in trouble. But I do think because of my profile, it's highlighted a lot more, you know.
That's it. But I think the fact that you're so good at football, like you've robbed friends' houses. You probably got a break because, you know, you knew them through football. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That being good at football, you know, Mickey Hart has given you a few breaks. You know, he's a compassionate man, but I'd say, like, if you weren't good at football, you might not necessarily have gotten some of the breaks that you got in as well.
No, probably not. Look, if I didn't play football, I don't know where I'd be, probably. Yeah. That's, to be honest, I don't know what road I'd have took. Like, because I love football so much, I didn't drink, didn't take drugs. So I looked after my body really well, and God knows where I'd be today, if probably even alive, if I didn't have football, you know. And that's a horrifying thing to say, but if I hadn't football, I probably wouldn't be here. That's an honest assessment of my life.
incredible. So we'll just get back, we'll shorten the story because there's so much in it. And like, I mean, people look at you and like you are in a lot of trouble. And I'd ask anybody to read the book because I root for you now after reading the book. You know, you've got some problems that you're trying to deal with, but like people who don't understand addiction and don't understand, you know, issues somebody might have, like it's easy to say, forget him, he's had enough chances. But if you read the book, you'll have a better understanding of it, because what you ended up doing to yourself is far worse than what you did to anybody else, you know, throughout the book. I think people should keep that in mind. But you robbed two of your good friends and you got threatened by the IRA that you had to go to London. Yeah. And you had to get out of the country.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I was in. One of them was in their house, I suppose, and I shouldn't have been in there. And if there had been anything lying around, I probably would have taken it. You know,
I didn't. I'd say there's no doubt about that.
Oh, there's no doubt about it, and I can hold my hand up. That's where I was at, and that's an awful place to be. I grew up with a guy that I went to school with, and I would have considered a very good friend, and I took advantage. Like, there you go again. It's the cliche that you hurt the people that you care about the most, and you feel like almost that they'll turn a blind eye to it because they're your friend. And then obviously a friend of mine, very good friend of mine, and club mate, stopped me and told me I was coming home from a meeting, and he stopped me and says, "Look at where are you?" And I says, "I'm just on the way home here." He says, "I need to talk to you," and he basically told me that, "Look at, you need to lie low here for a while, or go and get some help or do something, because there's a lot of people unhappy with what you're at, you know." And like, that was an awful thing to hear from a guy you played football with all your life, and you know, you won championship with, club championships, and that, and to hear that was, I broke down. Like, there's no point lying. I said to him, like, how did my life get to this point? Like, I tell him across the car, I says, "Lad, how did I get here?" Like, you know, and it was from there. Again, I was recommended by family to go to Killarney or go to Galway, go to Coonmore, and I didn't want to go because I knew how hard it was. I didn't want to go back there, and the brother was over in London, and I thought, like, I'll go over there and get away from everything, clean slate, go to meetings, full intentions of doing well and getting well. And went over there, and me and my brother's like best friends as well as brothers. He set me up and looked after me very well, and it was only a matter of time before I was back gambling again. I wasn't going to my meetings, so you can see the pattern. You don't go to your meetings, you go back gambling, and it's
yeah. You had no one really to hide on either.
Over there, nobody knew me. I could go into bookies. This was a new form of, I could take a day off work. Nobody would answer to, nobody in the family, nobody would say, "What are you doing out at work?" And I could go to the bookies, and that's what I was at again.
Yeah, that was a stupid decision, really, to go to London.
Worst decision at all. Yeah. The worst decision. Looking back now, the worst. And my brother said to me, "This is not the place for you over here." But I wouldn't listen. I couldn't listen to anybody. I wasn't in the right headspace to listen to anybody. And from there, just it was almost like a place that's a dark place. London is a dark place for a person. London's a tough place for someone on their own. That's in any way mentally right. But for me, it was the worst place I could have went to, you know.
So you're over there in your existing day-to-day, just getting by. You spend Christmas eating sausages and beans, you know, alone. You're able to gamble whenever you want. At one stage, you fluked 68 grand mm-hmm. on a treble maybe that you didn't even remember the night before. You just woke up and found this sitting in your account.
Yeah, it just shows you how much betting I was doing. I was putting on that many doubles and trebles and stuff. And
you were a poor gambler. Like, you weren't even thinking this is a clever bet. It's almost like you just want to lose your money.
Exactly. And it's strange to say that, but looking back now, I think unconsciously that's what I was trying to do, was just to throw it away. And there were days where I had my thousands in my account, but I just wanted peace, and I was just throwing money away for the sake of it, hoping if it wins, great. If it doesn't, who cares? You know, and I planned a trip to Brazil, like, and I'm going away there on my own in the World Cup. I'm not a guy that does them things. I don't go away places on my own. I'm usually in a group, or I like socialising, and, you know, look at that money. I didn't see a week. I didn't even get out of my account. I did try to withdraw it. I think I tried to withdraw the whole lot the first day, and it wasn't letting me do it. So it just went from there till, I think, 4 or 5 days. I actually put a deposit on that holiday, and I said to the girl I'd be in it, because I knew it'd take 3 days to go into your account, and
yeah.
I says I'd be in to pay the rest of it off, like, and 68 grand, sure, what was, I think it was 999, 10 grand for the whole unbelievable trip of a lifetime. And sure, I couldn't even go back to the woman, like, as the deposit was gone and everything else was gone. So you can imagine how bad a place I was in.
Yeah. And you 68 grand and you're not even feeding yourself, because you think even 2 quid on a sandwich is a waste. That's an absolute waste of money.
I could have 5 grand in my back pocket and I could be starving, and I wouldn't want to buy a sandwich, because I'd want that fiver to gamble with and not put it on a bet or to put it on food. Like, it's obscene, and it's you think about it and you think to yourself, it's insane living. And to go around thinking like that, and to, like, for a man that looked after himself, that's what it was actually getting worse. Like, I would always eat well and trained well, but in London it was deteriorating away. Like, I was, you know, I wasn't eating and I was losing weight, and I was just living. There was one day I just stayed, I didn't eat anything all day, bar a bar, a chocolate, a Yorkie bar or something, you know, and it was madness.
It's sad. That's what it is for someone being over in London with that, you know, problem. There's mad things going on through your head. Like, you thought about killing a shopkeeper, for example. Mm. Like, these are the kind of warped things that was going on in your head. And then one day you were back to no money again. I think it was after you blew the 68 grand and you saw the ad for the male models when you're on the subway.
Yeah, and I thought to myself, like, even thinking of doing modelling is insane, like, you know. But like, I became quickly aware that when I was invited in, that it wasn't a modelling agency, it was a porn company. And look, I was called back again another day, and the day I was called back, I had nothing in my pocket. I think it was a Wednesday. I jumped tubes to get there. I had no money to feed myself. At this stage, I was taking out of shops all the time, the odd bar and stuff, just to feed myself, slipping it in my pocket, like, you know, stealing. It was an awful way to be existence. And, you know, it come to this situation where this company says, look, there's no money in doing pornography with a woman. You have to do this with a man. And this is where...
So you're in at reception at this stage, or they bring you into a meeting?
They bring you into a meeting and do tests and all with you. And, like, in my mind, I was thinking that this... Right, it's pornography, you know. They were telling me that it'll just be in America, and, you know, and like, I can turn around and they probably seen a very, very a vulnerable individual looking back, but at the same time, it's a business, they don't care.
Yeah, but it's a shoddy business, because, yeah, like, you've mentioned in the book how often you were talking about the money and how desperate you seemed. Like, yeah. I mean, come on.
Look, if it had told me to do anything on that day, yeah, I'd have done it.
There's not many morals in the porn industry, anyways, I suppose. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, and you know, I had a great power in my mind to do things and to blank them out, and that went along with doing things that I'd done in gambling. Like, I'd done this thing, and it was horrific for me to do this. It was really, really, really hard, and people made a lot of jokes about it after and stuff, and when it come out and stuff, and they don't realise, by God, it had some effect on me, you know.
But I thought when I saw it coming out, and you mentioned in the book that a lot of teams were sharing it around groups WhatsApp. Mm. That's when I saw the pictures on a group WhatsApp, and it's like, Jesus. And I was thinking, right, you know, he's obviously bisexual. I know he's into girls, so, like, maybe it wasn't as bad. But when you coming out saying you were straight, I was there, and, like, he couldn't actually be straight, or how could he actually be able to get aroused, you know, with another man? But, you know, they were giving you Viagra.
Yeah. When you look at the video, it's not what's really happened, you know. It's you know yourself, editing and stuff. There was a hell of a lot of editing that went through that video. And it got to the stage where, as I talked
how
about...
How long was the whole ordeal?
It was a few hours with editing and stopping. And I said, I can't do this anymore. And you don't get paid unless you finish this kind of thing, you know. And
nice.
All I was thinking was the cash. Cash, cash, cash. All I could see was the money. And do you know what even topped it even off worse? That there was other guys in here doing the same thing after I was doing it, and they were straight as well.
Really?
And they were looking for the money. And the guy that I actually done it with, even he was straight. He worked for the company, and he was getting married later on that year. And I just couldn't get my head around it, you know.
So what he was doing, obviously, he was desperate for money in his own way as well, or you didn't really speak to him anyway.
This was his job.
Right.
This is the way he had his mind, that this was his job, and his partner didn't mind him having sex with men, but he wasn't allowed to have sex with women, and this is the world that they were in, like, yeah. You know, and look, I'm not judging anybody or here to judge anyone, but when you hear that, you know, you wonder, like, it's mad, it's crazy, like, and the boys coming in, this is an ongoing event, and there's boys coming in behind me, and they're straight as well, like, and like, they're obviously in a bad place too. You're not going to tell somebody you're in a bad place,
yeah,
but they must be.
And like, if you're gay, obviously that's fine, but for someone that's straight, like, that's just a horrific experience to have to do something like that in your own head if that's not your sexual preference.
Horrific. Look, at I would be very much so. I would very much respect the gay community for, they showed me a lot of support at the time when I did hit the rock bottom, and I have to say they were fantastic, the support they gave me. But for a gay that's not gay to do that, it was, look at, words can't even describe how tough it was, you know. But I have a great thing in my mind that when I left, shaking, visibly shaking, I could blank that out, and I got out of there. There was a news agent in the corner, and as soon as I got out of there, I seen the Ladbrokes on the corner. So I says, right, I'm going over there now to make this go away. I went into the news agents and got a Yorkie bar, and that's all I had eaten all day. I knew it'd keep me going, some chocolate, and I went into the Ladbrokes, and I gambled more than half my money straight away.
Gone.
And the only reason I hadn't gambled at all is because they were closing, and I couldn't gamble anymore. So I left that and went home in the tube, and I sat around looking at everybody in the tube, and I was thinking, imagine they knew what I had done. You know, I was just disgusted with myself because it was porn, like, and it's not, I'm from a farming wee small town in Dromore, a wee village, and like it's not something that you would think that it's good to be doing, you know. And it was a tough journey home. I took off the next day to work because there I had money, I wanted to gamble, and I wanted to double my money, get my money back. I was chasing the money I lost the day before, and it was gone. I don't even think I made it to 1 o'clock on the day before the real racing started. I had blown it all on virtuals
and racing, yeah.
All this crack, you know. And on these machines in the shop that you could bet online, I had it all gone before even proper racing was actually going to start, you know.
Yeah, so for some people reading the book, they'll read about how you robbed people that you loved, how, you know, you showed no respect for their money, you just got blew it the next day. But then, like I mentioned earlier in the interview, like, this is what you've done to yourself. This is how little respect you had for yourself, and how little respect you had for the money that you had earned in a horrific way, that it was gone within 24 hours. See, like, so that was just kind of blew my mind as to the levels gambling, you know, had taken you to.
Yeah. It had taken me till, look at, if you had told me a month before what I'd done that I would do that, I'd tell you, go and jump off a bridge. How would I do that? So it's safely safe for me to say that I would have done anything, probably. In a way, I'm happy that it was found, because if I was still out there, I could have killed somebody. You know, and there's no coming back for that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, the only person I really hurt out there was myself, you know. And I remember I went come into recovery one day, and a good friend of mine, Pat McGinn, says to me that, you know, did you kill anybody? And I says, no. And he says, well, look, it can be fixed. You know, and it's a very, very true saying. I believe that if I had kept going and gambling, I probably would have done or something horrific to myself or to somebody else.
What's the hardest thing to get over when you're in, you know, your therapy and things? Is it the actual act of hurting people that you love? Is it the actual porn that you can't get out of your mind? Or is it the paranoia when you're walking around that people are saying, talking about you doing those things?
That was probably the hardest thing to do in recovery, was to stop thinking and worrying about what people are thinking of me. It's very hard to do that.
Very difficult.
I've had to do a lot of changing. And now, till the day, like, I don't really care what people think of me. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way, in the slightest. But I'm never going to go out and make people like me anyway. So I just try and do my best. And if my best is not good enough, then I can't, you know, there's nothing else I can do. But that was the hardest point, like, was, I mentioned in the book that the first time I in the Thai, there was a GA Murfield were playing a Thai in a league match, and Joe Kelly invited me down to watch it, and I couldn't. He met me down at the pitch, and I was like, "Will you be there?" Like, and this is me fretting, you know, because I didn't want to be on my own. And I was in the car, and I till this day, it's only this last while that I realised it, but I took a panic attack. Never in my life would I ever took a panic attack, but I couldn't get out of the car with fear of the GA community is here. People's going to know me again, like, and they're going to know what happened, and I couldn't get out of the car. And I actually, to the extent where I was ringing away at Joe, and then I actually got him. He's like, "Jesus, is everything all right?" And he might have had about 6 or 7 missed calls, and I just says, like, "Where are you?" And I seen him over in the bank, and I walked up to him, and he says, "Is everything all right?" And he goes, "Aye, that's not too bad." And then I went up to the stand and started watching the match, and it wasn't as bad as I thought it was ever going to be, you know. But
yeah.
But your mind, that's the problem. Your mind thinks it's going to be a lot worse. And but it was a step. That was my first step, really, of coming back into the public eye.
Because obviously, when you start, it's a month after the gay porn scene that your phone starts hopping. Like, I thought it was funny where you're thinking, who could have found this, you know? Like, I mean, who could have found it and then put it up there? Is somebody, you know, I don't think they understood the impact that it was going to have on you. It was probably thought it was funny. But, you know, your phone's hopping, and then you come to the realisation in London, the gravity of what's after happening and that it's out there, and you go down to tube station and you think about jumping off the platform in front of a train.
Yeah, and that probably was the worst part of my life. That morning, that night, and that morning were the worst. If someone asked you, even the porn, like, the way I was feeling then was the worst I'd ever been feeling in my whole life. And
are you thinking of coming clean, or are you trying to think in your mind of ways, how can I get out? How can I deny this? Or are you saying, I'm done here?
I'm done. Yeah. I'm done with life. You know, I'm done with living this life. I just can't do it anymore, and I need peace. You know, and the only way I thought I was going to get peace was by ending my life. And you know, I had been in the area of a traumatic event a few weeks prior, that somebody actually had jumped out in front of a train track, and it sat in my mind that I was going to do this, you know. And oh, it was so close, hey, you know. And my brother probably was the one who saved me, you know. He was ringing and texting me and flat out, and everyone was ringing me, and I couldn't answer the phone because of the guilt and the shame of what I'd done. And I just told my brother, I'm wrecked here from gambling, I'm wrecked, and I just can't do it anymore, you know. I broke down, and he says, "Where are you?" He was a plaster out there, like, and he was doing very well for himself, and he goes, "I'm coming to get you, where are you?" So he just, like, another man rang me, Paul Coggins, London manager, abandoned tools and come running to get me, like, you know. And like, all them guys, by Jesus, like, all them people, I have so much respect for them, you know, to this day. And they probably never realise how much respect I have for them, but they saved my life. And you know, another thing that stopped me from doing it was thinking of my parents and family. If I'd done this, it would probably just destroy whatever family we had, you know. So thankfully I didn't do it, you know. And met Paul, and we ran Queen Mara, and you know, got myself sorted and you know, my father wanted to come and let me and all, and Ricey and all rang him and says, "Look, we'll come and get him, and we'll come and get him." And you know, that's what happened. They met me at Dublin Airport and says, "Look, you're not going to Galway, you're going to Newry, because Galway wouldn't take me because it was to do with the North and South thing now. It was just against their rules." And
okay,
look, I was glad to be going anywhere at that stage.
And Ricey didn't know what to say to you in the car on the way up.
No, he didn't. And it's very hard to be in that situation with friends and clubmates, you know, that I had so much shame and thinking, you know, I was just, I'm sure the boys will never forget it, like, I was just a shadow of myself, my former self. And I never spoke up the whole way, and I was crying up the road and sobbing and feeling sorry for myself. And you know, the boys were trying to then, you know, crack a few jokes and make it more light humour, you know. But they were saying to me, like, "Look, you need to get help here, like, you know," and that. And I even think one of them, Niall, even asked me, like, he said, look, lad, if you are gay, like, you know, it's all right, like, you know. And I knew deep down, I knew it wasn't. But he still asked me the question, like, and I says, look, I'm definitely not gay, like, you know. It's just where I was at.
Yeah.
It went from there, and I went into recovery and into Newry, and it was one hell of a journey in there, you know.
Yeah, and so you did the 3 months in Newry, and, you know, the valuable experience you got the last time, the 3 months you didn't think was enough to face the outside world, so you went down to a tie then, and you got some more recovery down there, and worked as a volunteer, and trained a little bit with the Thai senior football team, and gradually started to like football again, because at that stage you never thought you'd ever play again.
I fully said to myself that maybe I don't need this pressure or need this added, you know, football.
Because you were linking that in some way to maybe going back off the wagon.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe it was a bit of pressure and stuff, and look, it was never that, it was never the problem. Actually, the football was probably good for me in a way, you know, and I have to say to the lads in the Thigh, and managers down there, Pascal Keelan, he was the manager at the time, and the club and as a community, they welcomed me with open arms. I'm telling you, like, them boys done so much for me in terms of rehabilitation, almost so much that they could see the good person I am, and were even defensive of me if anybody would say anything about me, you know. They would kind of, what do you mean, you know, that kind of had me back, kind of a thing, like, you know. And like, them boys rekindled the love of the game I had again for the game, and I kept my head down and walked away, and I wasn't getting any money for it. I was doing it voluntary, and you know, I come into the room one day, and I suppose I'd been talking to Horace, Gavin Devlin, before, and says that he was saying that, look, we'd love to have you back and all, and I think he was the kind of the guy that went to heart and said, look, at McGarren, I think he's done an awful lot of work, and they were hearing good things back from me, what I've been doing. And Mickey then, I come in one day, I think it was from the gym down there, the Coonmore, I was obviously living there, they have a place for people that volunteer that live there, and there was a gym, and I probably just lived in the gym, you know. It was a good way to get anger out and different things to work on. And coming from the gym one day, and I had a missed call from this number I didn't know, and I rang back, and it was Mickey, and look at he heard about all the things I'd been doing, and says to me, look, if I was open to the idea, would I be interested in making a return, like, you know. And it was no pressure, like, at all. He just says, like, look, we'd love to have you back. And at that stage I was like, Jesus, wow, you know, I thought the door was closed. I thought I'd never play football again for club, never mind county. So yeah, that was I had to go and have a long hard think about it. It just wasn't a decision that was made on that day. Obviously I went and spoke to Oisín McConville, who's a sponsor of mine and a very good friend, and I went and talked to my counsellors about it. Was it a good idea? And my family, and you know, some people had mixed ideas, and do you need this again, and do you need this spotlight and stuff. And then the more I thought about it, the more I said to myself that I didn't want to be remembered for Cathal McCarron had done the gay pornography. I wanted to be remembered for who I am, and for my football ability, my ability. And you know the counsellors and people were all happy for me to go ahead. So I rang Mickey back and says, look, this was a while later. I says, I've had a good think about it, you know. And I says, I'd love to come back, like, you know. So it was a process in its own, you know, coming back into the public eye. And I read Gareth Thomas's book, which was a huge inspiration for me, because he come back into the public eye from saying, coming out he was gay at that time, for was a big news story, like, and a big deal. And I used him as huge inspiration. And I knew I had to make myself so strong, that because I knew, you knew yourself what football's like, there's a lot of shit thrown up at you in the games. And I went on to boards, discussion, but I'd never be on these things. But I knew there would be an awful, I knew even on Twitter, if I type my name in, there would be an awful lot of horrendous stuff to look at. So that's what I done. I faced it all. I just looked at everything that was wrote about me. It was very hard. Broke down a few times.
Is that advised by your...
Probably not.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Probably not, but...
It's like a form of self-harm or something.
Oh, look at it. It was something I felt that I couldn't go back. Like, I was thinking to myself, imagine somebody says something horrific someday and I break down in the field. I couldn't have that. If I was going to come back to play for Tyrone and help Tyrone, help my teammates, I had to be 100%, or else don't do it. So I done this, And look at it, it worked out for me, and it made me the person I am today, and I'm probably very mentally strong from it, you know.
Yeah, so you have two years later, you have two All-Star nominations, one still in the mix this year, could potentially get an All-Star. So, you know, you're 3 years now clean and sober from gambling, and you've a baby, you've a baby on the way, you're in counselling, you're doing a college course, you're in full-time work, you're training with Tyrone, you know, so you're trying to live a good life.
Trying to live, call him as good as life as I can live, and look at, no more man than myself is so sorry for everything I've done, but all I want is to be normal, have a normal life. I don't want to be in the paper and have headlines. If I want to be in the paper, it's about good stuff, about playing football for Tyrone or whatever, but I'm sick of all these, this crap, you know. I don't know if people think I like attention or whatever, but I actually am fed up with it, because it has a huge effect on my parents and family. Every time I'm in the paper, people don't realise that, right, these headlines, the effect it has on your loved ones as well. And it, you know, I'm just fed up with it, and I just want to go back to being me and just go through life and try and live life as good as I can for the rest of my life, you know.
Yeah, you say you had just finally, you say you get a buzz out of paying bills now, just having that normality and that structure that it's my money, but I'm actually going to pay a bill with my money instead of doing something stupid with it.
It's look what, I suppose, working down here and stuff in the south, it's almost like I've got a new record, a new clean slate, and just seeing bills come out of my account and seeing I've paid a phone bill or seeing I've paid a rent, it's almost like, wow, Jesus, it's good to be fit to do that, you know. It's strange, but the wee small things I appreciate so much in life. The wee things that normal human beings find probably a pain, I think, Jesus, it's good to, it's nice to be able to do that, to pay that bill, to have money to pay it and not run into the bookies to blow it, you know.
Yeah, well, listen, best of luck for the future anyways, and you know, I'm rooting for you. I honestly think anybody that reads the book will hope that this is the last we hear about Colin McCarron in trouble. It'll be just football stuff from now on. So listen, best of luck with the rest of your recovery.
Thanks very much, Colin. Thank you.
Yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
But these fellas will get such a f***ing shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their f***ing asses for f***ing 10 years.
The GAA Hour with Colin Parkinson is sponsored by AIB, proudly backing club and county.